Thanks, Marty. So it's a great pleasure to be back at Santa Barbara. I was here as a student. Can everybody hear me okay? And I'm being recorded somehow, I guess. So there was a famous quote. So I'll give this talk in two parts. We'll have a pause in the middle, and then we'll get on to the second part. And this is primarily for non-experts. So anybody whose face I recognize can leave now. I'm going to talk about just general features of electronic structure. I'll start with a quote from Dirac that is often quoted in our field, which is, and many of you will know this, from 1929. "The underlying physical laws necessary for the mathematical theory of a large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus completely known, and the difficulty is only that the exact application of these laws leads to equations much too complicated to be soluble." And many people talk about this in our field of electronic structure theory, and we'll get back to this quote as we go along. So yes, the first part is really the breadth of the subject, and this is really a tremendous physics success story. In the sense of many of the methods have been developed by physicists. Many of the people in our program are physicists, but they have gone into all branches pretty much of what I would call everyday science, the science of sort of real materials. And so part of this breadth, when you kind of go look at where people are doing electronic structure calculations, you find it in the Journal of Soil Science these days. You find it in the Journal of Protein Folding. You find it in astrophysics journals, looking at plasmas and things. And dyes and pigments. Who knew there was a journal called Dyes and Pigments, right? But there is, and they're doing electronic structure calculations. And I'm going to, talk about the, let's say, three common phases of matter. Things in the gas phase, molecules, isolated molecules, solids, we'll think of things as being bulk, and liquids, mostly water. So there are now literally, I don't know, tens of thousands of people, maybe more, running electronic structure calculations almost on a daily basis. There has been a huge sea change, for example, in chemistry, because somebody told me that they got a referee report, an experimental group sent in their results, and the referees really liked them, but they wanted to know had they been confirmed by theory. And actually, we'll get back to this, right? You can worry about the state of our field when you get referee reports like that. Okay, so what is the general problem, right? And I'm going to, talk about it in fairly straightforward terms. So we always start when we're the general problem is what atoms, molecules, and solids exist, and what are their properties? And we want to be able to predict them, really predict them, not just recalculate a number that's already been measured, but actually make real predictions about new materials. And what we always do in trying to solve this problem is, at least initially, we make the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which we're going to do. So we just imagine that the nuclei are nailed to the board here, let's say. And the simplest example we can do, the simplest case, and we'll use this to illustrate many concepts, is that of the H2 molecule. So we nail down two protons a distance r apart, and we have to solve, we're going to separate the nuclear and electronic problems and solve only for the ground state electronic energy. And in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, this gives you a curve, which we call the binding energy curve, which is the total energy as a function of R. So because the nuclei are more massive, this much more massive than the electrons, this works for many, many cases. And if we can calculate this total energy curve as a function of R, we can deduce many properties of our system. So for example, the minimum will tell us the equilibrium bond length of a hydrogen molecule. And this energy difference will tell us the thermochemistry, the energy required to take a couple of hydrogens and pull them apart. If we look at the curvature down here, we can figure out the vibrations of an H2 molecule, so we can calculate its vibrational spectrum. So there are many, many properties you can get. If you're looking at a solid, right, you can look at different possible lattices and ask which has the lowest energy to predict the lattice structure. You can look for that minimum and find the actual lattice constants, and you can calculate the phonons of the solid. All these things can be done if you can plot this curve sufficiently accurately. And that's going to be part of the story, is accuracy, because that'll be very important. So this total energy is the sum of two pieces, and the hard part is the electronic part. And I'll use atomic units throughout. So I guess we have a 1 over R plus, and this is the ground state of the electrons. Let me just use E0 of R. But here I mean the electronic part. And the difficulties arise because it's a many-body problem, right? So we all learn that we must start with our Hamiltonian for the electrons in a system. And I will write it just as T plus... I guess I'll just call this V and we'll write it out. So T is going to be the kinetic energy. This is the electron-electron repulsion. And this is the one-body potential. So for H2, for example, V is, we could write it as being minus 1 over R minus 1 over for the two nuclei in atomic units. I've said E squared and H bar and the mass of the electron to 1. And this is the one body potential. And the problem comes when we look at this piece here, the electron-electron repulsion, because the electrons repel with strengths comparable to the one body attraction to the nucleus. And so this is not a weak interaction. This is comparable to the attraction to the nucleus, and you can't easily solve this problem. But the point here is that all we need to know here is the ground state energy in order to plot this curve. And in the first half, I'll focus on ground state properties before we get to the excitations. And it gives you an enormous amount of information. And there are, you could sort of classify roughly the most common methods. For tackling this problem, in a certain sense, the most straightforward is to think about the wave function for the system and try trial wave functions. So the only difference between all the different problems is the external potential, the one-body potential that the electrons feel, and the number of electrons. And you must solve the Schrodinger equation for this Hamiltonian, and the number of coordinates that you have is equal to 3 times the number of electrons in your system. So this can be an enormous object to think about. And you must find the lowest possible wave function, which is totally anti-symmetric under interchange of the coordinates, because the electrons are fermions. So wave function methods are often, they start with Hartree-Fock. And that's when you approximate the wave function. So I'll use this for the many-body wave function, is approximately this guy, which is called a single Slater determinant. And a Slater determinant is an anti-symmetric product of single particle orbitals. And so the Hartree-Fock equations were first written down and solved in the 30s, and are basically the Hartree-Fock solution is the start of almost all modern wave function methods. And what you do is you find those orbitals that minimize the total energy. And that's very nice in the sense that it gives you a pretty accurate result for these kinds of things. However, it's not accurate enough. So the error in a typical Hartree-Fock calculation, it will underbind by about 4 eV per bond, several electron volts. So we need to discuss a little bit energetics here. So physicists, while we use atomic units as a common language, then for many interesting properties as physicists, we use electron volts. Chemists will tend to use kilocalories per mole, of which there's about 20 in an electron volt. And biochemists will use kilojoules per mole, and there's about 4 of them in a kilocal. And the reason that you do this is because the scales that people care about are differ. So for example, if you undermine everything by 4 eV, you cannot do any thermochemistry. This is far too large an error. Now notice that the total energies in your system may be thousands or tens of thousands of Hartrees, so a huge number, but what you care about are energy differences. The difference is between when the molecule is bonded and when there are separated atoms, or between one conformation of a molecule and another. And so a 4 eV error is totally useless for looking at thermochemistry. On the other hand, it gives you a picture, a very good picture in your head, of what's going on in the electronic structure of the problem. So people for many years use this and think about orbitals, these Hartree-Fock orbitals, and almost all the basic chemistry books are written in terms of them, and especially the highest occupied molecular orbital, which is the highest one that's occupied in this Slater determinant, and the lowest unoccupied one. And when you think about molecules interacting with each other, you think in terms of these frontier orbitals. And these were used as the basis of many calculations for many years in order to understand sort of chemistry, but on the other hand, it wasn't accurate enough to do thermochemistry because these errors are too big. So it's qualitatively very good, but quantitatively not good enough. And to get an idea of this scale again, one thing that modern chemists, especially in organic chemists, like to do is calculate reaction mechanisms, to figure out reaction mechanisms, so you try to calculate a transition state. So a transition state for a molecule is between a reactant form and a product form, and in between you find the lowest energy path, and the top of the barrier is the transition state. And if you're doing, say, looking at something that's of interest to biochemists, at room temperature, an error of 1 kilocalorie per mole in your calculation has an effect of a factor of 5 in the rate of the reaction. So if you're designing modern drugs and things like that, right, you really don't want a huge error in some of the rates of these reactions, right, because they're going to tell you which ones go, which ones don't. Now that's 1 kilocalorie per mole. A kilocal is about a 20th of an EV, and this is 4 EV in error. Okay. But from Hartree-Fock come many modern methods. Many, let's say, better wave functions. And in our first formal talk, Lubos Mitash will talk about the state of quantum Monte Carlo, where you take trial wave functions with Jastrow functions in front of these Slater determinants, and you minimize the energy and you get highly accurate results. And there's a growing community using these quantum Monte Carlo, electronic quantum Monte Carlo, to get very accurate results. A second way that people look at these problems is Green's function methods. But generally speaking, and these are sort of the standard toolbox of physicists, but generally speaking, the Green's function methods often give you much more accurate results. So in those, you write down some approximation to the single particle Green's function of the problem. It's the many-body problem, but it's a single particle Green's function. You can write various equations that the Green's function satisfies, but if you want to come up with anything approximate that you can solve on the computer, you need to truncate those equations in some way or another. And interestingly enough, many of the Green's functions methods give you very good response properties of the system. They tell you about the spectral function well, but often they're not so good if you try to turn them into something variational and try to get the ground state energy out of them. And then there's what I call the 800-pound gorilla, right, which is density functional theory. And this was a completely different way of tackling this problem, which we're going to go into in a little bit of detail. But what's interesting is that this doesn't look anything like this thing or this thing, and it's a way of recasting this minimization problem of finding the ground state energy in terms of just the electronic density alone. So in this method, you write a functional for the given one-body potential of the electronic density. So N of R is equal to the one particle electronic density. So it tells you N of R times D3R tells you the probability of finding one electron somewhere in space. And you write down an approximation to the ground state energy as a functional of the density, and find the lowest energy that way. And the reason this is the 800-pound gorilla is because almost all the sort of common everyday calculations, and indeed many of the more sophisticated methods, start from a density functional calculation. Okay. And it's this that has led to this huge number of people now doing electronic structure calculations. Now there are two distinct things, two distinct approximations in an electronic structure code. One, the simpler one, is the basis set, and the other is the method. And these refer to the method. These are different ways of approaching the problem. The basis set is, on the computer, you can't just, how to put this? Any really interesting problem tends to be at the limit of your computer's capacity. Because if you think about it, that makes sense, because otherwise somebody will have done it already, right? And so basis sets are very important. You can't just, discretize all of space as much as you like and try to solve this, whichever differential equation you end up getting. You choose basis sets. And the world is largely divided, although that divide is happily beginning to disappear, into people who do plane waves. Now, versus localized functions. And actually, so the middle part of the talk, which we're going to get to quite shortly, is really about sociology between physicists and chemists. And I'm going to have to ask for the camera, or whatever it is, to be turned off, because I have a few jokes that I don't want. But I certainly don't want getting back to my home department, which is the chemistry. Actually, so a few of you know me for a few years, right? Know that I actually grew up in Ireland. An important thing in growing up in Ireland is to have a sense of humor, especially about yourself, right? So let's get back to these. So plane waves are preferred generally by solid state physicists. The great thing about your plane waves is because the subject grew up with bulk solids, you can use Bloch's theorem, expand everything in terms of the Bloch states of the system, and very systematically do your plane waves up to some cutoff, right? And the great thing is that there's just one scale. You do more and more waves, you get higher and higher frequency, and so you just do as many plane waves as you need to converge the basis set. So the idea is this is really up to the user to take whatever basis set they're given and include enough basis functions so that you converge to the converged answer for the given method. In chemistry, people have largely used localized functions almost entirely, which these days are usually Gaussians centered on the atoms in the molecule. So you'd put a Gaussian on top of each of your hydrogen atoms. Well, you put usually quite a large number of Gaussians. And the great thing about doing this is that you can make your calculation go a lot faster than a plane wave calculation, because you're choosing basis functions that are designed for the specifics of the problem. You choose them so that they can polarize toward each other and much more rapidly converge. On the other hand, it's very unnerving for physicists generally, because you don't know sort of what the convergence parameter is, right? It's just you add enough until it stops changing and so forth. Of course, and it's kind of funny the way things have evolved, because the chemists can now come back because of this density functional theory and say, well, this density functional theory is a quite unsystematic approach to all these different functionals and things that people use. So these things go much faster typically, but on the other hand, they don't have a single parameter which you can keep ratcheting up to be sure that you've converged. Okay. One last thing I want to explain in this part is, Winston Churchill said that America and England are two great countries separated by a common language, or something like that, right? The word ab initio, right, is rather controversial. within electronic structure theory. So if you talk to a physicist, the word ab initio, well, so let me first describe what we're trying to say with this word. So the idea is that you can either get for free or pay for an electronic structure code. If you're doing an experiment and you want to model what's going on, you get your hands on a code. You can choose the basis set and you can choose the method, but nothing else. What you feed into the code are the actual nuclei of your system, and then you're going to, say, minimize the ground state energy to find the geometry, to find the bond lengths and the bond angles. That's what we could think of as ab initio or first principles, meaning there are no empirical information coming from the outside about the system. The code gives you the answer. And once you report these two pieces of information, it's something that can be reproduced by anybody. There's nothing to adjust, right, that the user gets to adjust. So ab initio, that's what it means in general, right? Unfortunately, right, in chemistry, this word means specifically wave function methods and does not mean density functional methods. Density functional methods are usually regarded as empirical in some vaguely defined way. On the other hand, in physics, because you can't really do a wave function calculation, or at least not till quite recently, for bulk systems, ab initio means density functional theory. And so they really go at it sometimes, right? Because they use the word, this is an example of using the same word to mean two opposite things. Okay. So before we get into the middle part, right, are there any questions? Or that's what I said. Made sense to everybody. There is a quiz, so it's important to ask questions. And people who know me know I'm not kidding, right? Because I always have a quiz. Everything is straightforward. Okay. So yes, now we get into the sociology here. So as I was saying, so it's right really on, so. You can say this is the physics world of electronic structure, right? Now, I know this is going to come as a blow to many of you, right? But here's chemistry, right? It's huge, right? And out here, right, of course, you know, there's the enormous world of bio, right? Which could eat up all of them in one shot, right? But our stuff is on, sort of on this interface, right? And I've spent the last, I don't know, 15 years sitting in chemistry departments. So I've sort of thought about the difference between physics and chemistry, right? And so in my opinion, an interesting thing is that I know it's hard for you guys to understand this, but chemistry is actually a different science, right? Not all sciences are physics. Right? But it really is different in the sense that the primary aim of chemistry is to make stuff. And the primary aim of physics is to understand stuff. Now, of course, many of the chemists that you guys would meet would actually be what real chemists would call essentially physicists, because you would meet physical chemists who are trying to understand things. But the overall motivating goal of chemistry is to make stuff. If you can't make stuff, then nobody really cares, right? And another way of putting this is that, a physicist would rather be right than useful. And because the recording equipment is on, I won't finish that. Well, I will. Okay, so a chemist would rather be useful than right. And I work in both areas, so I combine the best of both worlds. I'm never right, and I'm certainly never useful. Okay. But because I'm not just kidding, right? Because of this, right? You can't just be in this field a sort of physicist who wants to understand how all the sort of global properties and all the general things and how to do all that kind of stuff, right? That's great, and you can, you know, I'm going to get to some very interesting problems and questions and so forth, very fundamental things. But in the end, people need high accuracy, high efficient calculations, right? It doesn't matter what year it is, right? You have a computer of a certain size. That size is always going to limit how big a calculation you can do. You can always try to beat the Schrodinger equation to death, and you will run out of steam very quickly doing that. And so you have to come up with methods that balance accuracy with efficiency, right? You can't be making errors of 4 EV, right? That's just useless to everybody. And so this balance is the important thing, because without the balance, your stuff is not going to be useful. And if it's not useful, it's not going to be applied. On the other hand, you can look at it another way around, is when you think about, you know, the very, very fundamental issues in this area, you have this huge captive audience, right? It's not many branches of physics in which, if you do make some little bit of progress, an enormous number of people are going to use it very quickly. So there's this sort of trade-off, right, in this game between needing to do sort of fundamental theory to make advances. On the other hand, it has to be something that will actually produce something useful, which means it must be efficient and accurate. And it's that sort of dividing line that's terribly, terribly important. Still with me? So what is this? I'm going to give you a very quick idea of what this density functional theory stuff is, my version. This is the stupidest possible version. That's why it's my version, not DFT. So because it's very important, because as I say, it is the sort of mainstay of all the stuff that's going on. And a simple way to think about it is you take the first problem that you solved in kindergarten, which is the particle in a box, right? The first quantum problem that almost anybody has seen is this. And let me make the box of length 1. In atomic units, and you learn to solve your Schrodinger equation, and the potential is zero except at the edges, and you get your eigenstates, √2 sine j pi x will be your eigenstates, and your eigenfunctions in atomic units are pi squared 2 over j squared, j equals 1, 2, da-da-da. So that's the solution of the Schrodinger equation for the particle in a box. And if you wanted to calculate its kinetic energy, you would learn from your book that you must, well, what we're going to do first is put n particles in this box. Let me do that. So this is the lowest state, right? J equals 1. And if we solve for the second one, we'll get one node. This is J equals 2. And so on. Now let's imagine we have n fermions in this box, and we'll have them same spin fermions, so they each occupy one level. So for example, imagine that there are four fermions. So this makes it look like more like an electronic problem. So then if we wanted to calculate the density, we were told that we must sum these orbitals from 1 to 4. And if we wanted the kinetic energy, we would do, let's say, 1/2 we would sum the squares of the derivatives of the orbitals, and this would give us the exact kinetic energy, which in this case is just the total energy because they're confined to the box with infinite walls at the edges. Now, you can easily deduce for this problem, and we won't go through it in any detail, that you can approximate the kinetic energy by what we'll call the local approximation, and T local is going to be the in general from minus infinity to infinity, but here we're stuck in the box, n cubed of x. So where does that come from? The density for a single particle for one dimension has units 1 over distance, and the kinetic energy is an integral of things with 1 over distance squared. So you can make a dimensional argument to come up with the n cubed, and then you can decide what the constant is in front in order to fix your approximation. And for example, you can take a uniform system and discover that this coefficient in the case of a completely uniform system is pi squared over 6. And so if you take, so this is a density functional approximation in the sense that you're trying to approximate the result of an operator, the expectation value of an operator, with an integral over the density. And if you look at how well it behaves, you find that if n is 1, the exact ground state energy is pi squared over 2, and this T local is approximately 4.1, I think. It's about a 20% underestimate. And if you put in another particle, then you'll occupy the next level, which will be 4 times higher, so you get 5 pi squared over 2, and the percentage error goes down to, I think it's an 11% underestimate. So this is what a density functional is, and I'm applying it to the exact density of these particles in the box. And as you put in more and more particles, it becomes more and more accurate. And in fact, in the limit, as n goes to infinity, this becomes exact, because if you put an awful lot of particles in your box, the density is almost uniform everywhere. Interestingly, if you take any one-dimensional problem with bounded potential and put in a large number of particles, this thing will always become relatively exact. And this is telling us a little basic lesson that density functional theory works for large numbers of particles, works worst when you have one particle. It's the error, this was about a 20% underestimate. And also, we can see that if we use the density functional theory directly to solve this problem, I said we evaluate this on the exact density. If we apply directly, in the sense that we minimize the total energy, which is just this guy, right? So if we want to find the density using this, we have to differentiate this with respect to the density. We get pi squared over 2, n squared of x is equal to the chemical potential. As it turns out, it's just a constant. So this implies n of x is the number of particles divided by the length of the box, which in our case is just 1. So this would give you, instead of, so say we have 5 particles in our box, that n over l gives you this line here. So let's say we'll call it self-consistent, even though we didn't do anything self-consistent. And that line is not bad, right? You can see it's a rough approximation to the actual density. But you get a much bigger error if you just use that line, because then you're off by a factor of 3. You get pi squared over 6 for one particle instead of pi squared over 2. But once again, if you keep putting particles into the box, in the end it becomes relatively exact. So this tells you also that you know, you can have an approximate functional that gives you a good approximation to a total energy, but if you then want to get a derivative of this thing in order to solve things self-consistently, it may not work so well. But this is the way density functional theory works, in the sense that it's approximate functionals of the density. And in 1964, Holmberg and Cohn proved that the energies, in fact, all properties in the many-body problem can be written as functionals of the density. And so put density functional theory on a sort of firm footing by proving a one-to-one correspondence. So everything in this field changed in sort of 64 and 65. So prior to this time, this sort of theory was applied quite liberally, especially in solid state physics, and it was called Thomas Fermi theory. And in Thomas Fermi theory, you make an approximation for the kinetic energy as a functional of the density. You make the Hartree approximation for the electron-electron repulsion, which is also a function of the density. You're approximating the full quantum mechanical electron-electron repulsion just by its classical electrostatics, and you keep the one-body potential. And so when you do that and minimize the energy, you get what's called classical Thomas Fermi theory. And that gives you qualitatively good results for if you're a physicist, but not if you're a chemist, because Teller proved that molecules don't bind in Thomas Fermi theory. Because here you're having a factor of three error if you do this directly. If you solve the equations by minimizing that energy, you get these huge errors. On the other hand, right, in 65 came along these Cohn-Sham equations. What am I supposed to stop, Marty?
20 after.
Okay. These Cohn-Sham equations, and what they did was they said, well, imagine a fictitious set of electrons, non-interacting electrons, whose density is exactly the same as those of the solutions in the many-body problem. And so they defined this fake set, this fake Schrodinger equation, of orbitals. So these are called the Cohn-Sham equations, and this effective potential, they wrote a formula for it in terms of, they wrote the total energy in terms of the kinetic energy, the Hartree, the one body, and a mysterious missing piece, the exchange correlation energy. And they simply define the exchange correlation energy by this difference between the full many-body ground state energy and these guys here. And they showed a very important formula that you can, if you know this as a functional of the density, you can figure out what that potential is. And this gives you an exact scheme, an exact workaround for solving the entire many-body problem in principle, if you could only know this exchange correlation energy. And you can see what this does here in this little toy problem, because what this does is you're going to solve a set of quantum equations, right, for orbitals, and they will have all this beautiful quantum oscillations and Friedel oscillation, all sorts of things can be built into that. And you get a much more accurate density by solving this set of equations, and the only real work, I mean, you only approximate a very small part of this potential, and the real work is done trying to get the ground state energy. And so you get much more accurate answers. And they introduced the local density approximation, which is exactly the same spirit as this, but for this exchange and correlation. They put in the uniform gas, and that became the standard way of doing electronic structure in solid state physics for pretty much a generation. It was never taken on in chemistry because Hartree-Fock underbinds by 4 electron volts. This local approximation overbinds a typical chemical bond by about 1 electron volt. And again, you still can't do chemistry. What happened in the late 90s was that various people, especially John Popel with a commercial code, showed that you could, with modern density functional approximations beyond the local density approximation, get highly accurate results comparable to those of some of the best quantum methods solving directly the Schrodinger equation. You could get, let's say, reasonably accurate results for many molecules with improved approximations called generalized gradient approximations, and they cut down the error by a factor of 3 or 4 further. It's still not the accuracy you need to predict the rate of chemical reactions, but it was good enough. It was what we call useful accuracy in order to predict many, many things. So one of the things that came out of that, for example, is that Matthias Scheffler, one of our coordinators who isn't here yet, during the mid to late 90s, it was pretty much a huge sea change in surface science, because suddenly you could do these calculations where you take molecules and you put them on surfaces and you could tell where they would go. You could see, does it go on an on-top site or a hollow site or whatever. The energetics were good enough to be able to make those kinds of predictions. They're not always correct. Sometimes the energetic differences between two sites are very tiny and make mistakes. But this completely changed surface science because you knew where the molecules were on your surface. And of course, in 1998, Walter Cohn and John Popel got the Nobel Prize in Chemistry and were standing in Cohn Hall. And also, I think it was last year, Gerhard Oertel, who's in the same institute for Tauber with Matthias Scheffler, got a Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the experimental work that he'd been doing. Maybe it was the year before last. Okay. So that gives you the sort of general background to density functional theory, and now I'm going to get to the sort of excitations and the hard parts, okay, in the last 10 minutes. Wait, I've forgotten to do the quiz. So actually, the quiz is a little harder than it usually is because I didn't stress the important point. So now we have to divide the audience into the experts are people whose faces I recognize, at least from electronic structure days, right? And the non-experts are everybody else, especially anybody under the age of 40, right? So when you write down these Cohn-Sham equations, right? And you come up with some nifty little formula for this missing part of the many-body energy, right? And then you solve these equations self-consistently because this guy depends on the density, so you guess, you put it in, you solve, and you guess again. So can anybody say why that's going to be much faster than doing a traditional wave function calculation where you directly solve for the many-body wave function of the Schrodinger equation? Why that would be much faster. What is it that's different about this set of equations? So what you're going to do is you're going to occupy the different levels of this one body potential, extract your density, solve itself consistently, versus solving the Schrodinger equation directly for this Hamiltonian. Thank you.
Well, the wave function depends on 3n coordinates. If you have n particles, density of wave depends on 3.
Thank you, Walter Cohn. yes, exactly. This only depends on 3. Well, that's let's say a slight simplification, but the main point is that these equations are non-interacting, right? So the things decouple. So these equations are quicker to solve than even the old Hartree-Fock equations, at least formally. And so that's what made all the difference, because you can solve things that are roughly 100 times bigger than things you can solve by directly solving the wave function. Good. So score one for the non-experts. Now the question for the experts is, so there's this local density approximation where the exchange correlation energy depends on the density of the uniform gas, which we always use this RS parameter, doesn't matter what it is. So the question for the experts is that RS equals to, can you tell me what the exchange correlation energy is of the uniform electron gas to six significant digits? So zero for the experts, right? So that's just to sort of demonstrate that, you know, they don't actually know everything, right? Even though they often pretend to. Okay. So what are the things we don't know? So everything I've told you about is ground state stuff, right? And I had to tell you all that stuff because that's the background in which we're working, right? But the title of our workshop is Excitations, okay? So 90% of what you want to know is this stuff here, but then the other 10% usually is the excitations. And so all this DFT stuff just gives you the ground state energy. So let me very quickly talk about that. What has sort of happened, so this huge enterprise is now sort of ongoing, and of course as soon as things start working for many people, then they want more, right? And in particular, they want the excitations of the electronic excitations are very important for many, many processes. So there are various ways, right? So excitations. So we're talking about electronic excitations, right? You can get the vibrational and rotational excitations from the ground state. But the electronic excitations, now why are these important, right? So you may or may not know that in the last year, Department of Energy issued this Grand Challenges report. It's a great piece of work in which they talk about the, you can get it off the web, but watch out because it's 30 gigabytes. They talk about four or five basic problems that need to be solved that will help us with the energy question, right? And one of them, of course, one of the big things that people are hoping for, betting on, is photovoltaics. And we don't know much at all about many of the processes that go on in converting light into electricity as they go through these very complex materials. And the things that we have at the moment, at least the things that are relatively cheap, are extremely inefficient, and we don't really understand how everything works and how to improve it. So we would definitely like to be able to do electronic structure calculations and help with that situation. And Claudia, another of our coordinators, works on organic semiconductors, which are a very good possibility. And there are lots of problems with the things I've told you about trying to apply them to organic semiconductors. And also on Thursday, Sushi Guha, an experimentalist, will tell us about all the intricacies of trying to follow the excitations in these systems. And so, So excitations, this whole thing was designed not for excitations, but ground state. So we have a few different ways of treating them. One that's become very popular is time-dependent density functional theory. And this was created by, the modern version was sort of defined by Runge and Gross in 1984, and he'll be here in a month. And in this time-dependent DFT, you apply the same ideas as in ground state DFT, but to a time-dependent external potential. And if you have a time-dependent electric field, it excites the system and it tells you where the excitations are. So there's this TD DFT, and that's very nice, and all the quantum chemistry packages have now included it, and people are getting great results for their bacteria or whatever it is, chlorophyll A. Actually, it's kind of funny because it turns out that there are still, you know, a few errors in our functionals for TV-DFT, and it turns out that if you really look at the calculation for chlorophyll A, the grass is yellow, not green. That's less than an EV, right? I got into trouble with my kids over that one. So TD-DFT is a newish method for, and in principle, exact, and all that kind of stuff. But our knowledge of the functionals is very limited, and also it has severe problems for extended systems, which is kind of tough when you're working on materials, right? Because we tend to use functionals that are local, in the sense that, you know, this just depends on the density at a given point, it turns out that in order to get excitations right in extended systems, you've got to introduce some more non-locality. The same kind of non-locality as in the Hartree piece, and we don't really know how to do that well yet. So our standard way of really getting excitations is called GW. So this is a Green's function method, and what you do is you look at the Dyson equation for the one-body Green's function and approximate the self-energy by Green's function times the screened interaction. And if you do GW, you get good results for extended systems, and in particular, you get good gaps so the gap in an insulator is the difference between the ionization potential and the electron affinity, and if you do a standard DFT calculation with LDA or GGA or whatever, typically your cone sham gap will be smaller than the true gap, and even if you do cleverer things to calculate the real gap, you'll still come out with it too small. If you do a GW calculation, and these have been around since the 60s, and say Stephen Louis is one of the people who've really pushed that, you tend to get very good gaps. The trouble is, if you do a GW calculation, what you tend to do is a GW calculation not self-consistently. You start off with a cone sham calculation, get your orbitals, feed them in, create a Green's function, and do a one-shot deal to calculate the response function with this GW, and you see a good gap. If you do it self-consistently, you can get a better energy, ground state energy, but your gap goes wrong. And so gaps are really kind of hard thing in this area. What else? One other thing I want to mention particularly is transport. So this will be the last one I'll mention. So let's say GW gaps, figuring out the connection between DFT and its gaps and methods of doing better gaps is really important. And transport, a big problem. Again, this is in photovoltaics, is how do you calculate the IV characteristics of, let's say, typically an organic molecule between two metal leads. This is a huge business. Many people are trying to, you know, think about making computers out of molecules, and they would really like guidance from electronic structure theory. And how do you calculate the IV characteristics of one of these situations? And you can do DFT calculations, but they're less accurate than they are for many other things, and people have argued for the last 10 years over why this is and are the experiments good enough and so forth. So I'll just finish. So 3 weeks ago I was at a meeting in Long Island that was a meeting of DFT types. So DFT is mostly applied to what are called weakly correlated systems. My definition of a weakly correlated system is one in which the spectral function of your cone sham system looks qualitatively like the real one. There are no new features coming out of the many body effects. And so this was where weakly correlated and strongly correlated people were talking to each other, and And we're going to have a program at KITP in January on strongly correlated systems. And so I've been watching this transport problem for 10 years with the organic molecule benzene dithiol between two gold electrodes. And we're going to have a session on the transport thing, and it'll be theorists, and they're going to show their calculations. And I was the chair. So in order, and it was the last session of the meeting, and everybody was tired and so forth, and didn't look like it was going to be that exciting. So in order to make it more exciting, right, what I did was, excuse me a minute, I hope I don't mess up the recording. I took out a $20 bill, and there was a sort of cut in the podium so you could actually hold it like that, right? And so I put the $20 bill up there, and I said, if anyone can give me an IV conductance of one of these things from a calculation, honestly, within 20% of the experiment, they get the $20. And I was pretty confident I'd keep my $20. And it worked great because it was like a truth-telling device. Because every speaker who would come up, would, you know, you couldn't avoid it. It was there, right? And what we'd always get at the start of the talk, instead of like, what great stuff I've done, it would be, well, yeah, I've done this great stuff, but I'm not going to be claiming the $20, right? And then the last speaker on transport was a young guy called Jeff Neaton, and he got up and he explained how they had taken standard DFT calculations but combined them with GW to figure out how levels at surfaces get shifted, because you can get the positions of the levels well with GW, like getting the gaps well. And you could put in corrections to your DFT calculation that shifted the positions of the orbital levels on the molecule. Now, the transport of electrons through the molecule is a resonant process, and so where the levels exactly are is terribly important. So they went through this procedure of shifting the levels based on sort of gas phase calculations, but completely non-empirical. And their error compared to the standard molecule that people look at was 17%. And he said, that's under $20. Sorry, I mean 20%. And I was really impressed. And this was this guy was the youngest by far of the people speaking. And I had to give him the $20. You know. Later, I broke both his legs, but that's another story. When I met him at the airport. Okay, so I could go on for another hour quite easily, but I'm going to stop here in case there are questions. So thank you for your...
Any questions from people not part of the program?
What's the latest on chemical reaction?
Not really. It depends on which chemical reaction, right? If you're looking at something sort of very simple and straightforward, yes, you can probably get something roughly right. But usually you're looking at something quite interesting. I mean, the molecules that people can make these days are fantastic. And you need this transition state to within, like something like 1 kilocal per mole. And you can do a calculation and get sort of results that sort of agree with experiment, but there are so many things that you have to kind of kludge in one way or another that it isn't really a sort of predictive process in this sense. It isn't a standard thing that people could do. And you need just, let's say, one more improvement of 2 or 3 in the accuracy of the calculation. The other thing, which I didn't really mention here, that's a very important problem, is that usually you want to look at things, say, in solution, and then you can forget it. I mean, we have Parnell molecular dynamics, and whoa, you can do 64 water molecules, right? But you have some horrible enzyme or whatever it is, and it's just no chance. And so what you do is you do molecular mechanics for all that part of the problem, and then you cut out a little piece and you treat that with DFT or whatever. And that cutting process is, nobody knows how to do it right. So there are so many bits in between. If you know the answer in advance, you can usually hit it pretty good, but you wouldn't want to bet your life on it, right?
Any questions?
I'm in the quantum information group, and one of the things I work on is quantum walks, which are sort of hot right now and models for algorithms. But in in the last year or two, there have been several papers claiming that transported excitations in photosynthesis it can be described as some type of a quantum walk. That is, it's a coherent transport process. So should we believe any of that? And I mean, not to cast doubt on it because I don't understand it well enough, but I mean, is there some place where one comes in? We generally assume that we have very sort of pure quantum systems that have highly coherent behavior. And here it seems like you have these very messy, muddy problems. So is there some place where these might actually come into contact?
Yes. So, in fact, I've been thinking about this kind of thing with the guys at UC Irvine, the chemistry guys. And so it seems what happens is when you get these situations where, you know, these sort of light harvesting complexes and so forth. So to model the system, right, is extremely complicated, right? There are all these sort of degrees of freedom and everything going on, right? But whenever you have something like this, there are so many pathways in which you lose coherence that is absolutely the default of what goes on, right? You sort of start a process and it decoheres very, very quickly. And when things become quite complicated and in solution, that kind of always happens, right? So it seems like the ones that do it definitely do have some, you know, something of this kind going on, but we have no way at the moment of sort of pinning it down because of all the gaps between the different ways of doing the calculations. So, but it isn't going to be something that looks as pure as the systems that you guys look at, right? But there'll be a bit of it, and so it'll be right on the border. But in some sense, it isn't going to be bulk, you know, generic behavior, but some very special thing that goes on, but we don't know what it is my guess, right, as to how that goes on. We can discuss it after, yeah.
Anybody else? Well, thank you, Julia Schein, and thanks for your view. And for those who are in our program,
we have an organizational meeting at 2:00 where?
Thank you. Small seminar.